Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and Mike Malott. A little later, Representative Scott Van Single from Grant will be joining us. He's going to be talking about a potential alternative to closing the teacher retirement plan, otherwise known as MIPSERS, which currently has the budget negotiations on the deep freeze. But first, guys, let's talk about some news from this morning. Lena Epstein, a former co-chair for Trump campaign here in the state of Michigan, has thrown her hat into the ring as a candidate for the U.S. Senate for 2018, the first Republican to officially announce. John, I wanted to get your thoughts on Lena Epstein as a candidate.
It makes it interesting to think about. Obviously, I think if the Republicans want a solid opponent to Debbie Stabenow, having a woman run, it's not a bad thing. Having someone who comes from the business community hopefully has some resources is not a bad thing.
So Jack, 35 years old, she is the co-owner and general manager of Vesco Oil Corporation, but maybe more importantly is she's really tied her short political career, what we know of it, to Donald Trump. And from a Republican standpoint, if you kind of start with the impression that 2018 is going to sink or swim based on how Donald Trump is doing, why not have somebody who has connections to Trump?
Well, basically, what it amounts to at this point is if nobody else jumps in, she's in the catbird seat. The Donald Trump connection, one would assume that there would be a carryover of being the outsider and having that kind of a hook or that kind of a campaign saying, I'm from the outside, I'm a novice at this. So there could be some continued appeal there and so on. So, yeah, as far as getting the nomination for the Republicans, again, if no one of substance jumps in, and that's a big if, afterward, that could be very obtainable. The minute you get into the general and she's taking on somebody like Debbie Stabenow, that is a major lift at that point.
Because if you think about it, Jack, having the support of Donald Trump works in a couple ways. Because if he shows up one day to do a fundraiser, that's a ton of money that he could potentially bring to the table. And not only that, if he endorses her, there you have that carryover effect. For whatever reason, it seems like for as much stuff that comes out for Donald Trump, the polling doesn't seem to switch all that much. I mean, he still seems to have the same kind of basic level of support, which could be advantageous for her.
Just to kind of go back on what Jack said here, and she says it right in her own statement. I mean, Michigan spoke loud and clear. We want an outsider with business leadership skills. So this message, this outside thing, she said, I will speak for those who have not been spoken for. This outsider speaking for the people, it's something that worked. I mean, that's something that everyone is trying to, I think, take out of Donald Trump's playbook. And so she worked with him. She's adopting his message. And it's something that worked before, and she wants to carry it forward.
A couple things that I've picked up on Lena Epstein, she does not have a very deep history in campaign finance as far as donating to campaigns. There is some question about how much money of her own she is willing to put in to her campaign. I think we all know that in politics, money begets money, and the more that you're able to put in, the more attractive it is for others to put in money as well. They feel like if you're vested, well, then they can vest in you as well. So we're going to have to keep an eye on that. Another interesting fact that she's talked about before is that she's pregnant. She's going to be giving birth to her first child in October. And Mike, as parents, just something to keep in mind. We'll see what kind of impact that has on her in October or November. I think she said she was going to have the child in October. That's the schedule right now. So I guess we'll see how that works. But any thoughts on this announcement today?
She doesn't have a lot of name recognition. As we talked about her, everybody in the room kind of said, who? If she ties her wagon to Donald Trump, I think it very much depends on how well he does. His presidency is very young. Go either way at this point. And if she's going to start raising a family, that has its own strains, as any parent knows. So that could cause personal pressures that make it hard for her to find the time to find the energy to stay with it. But that, of course, doesn't rule it out.
Well, no,
we've all had children. So.
Right, right, exactly. That's nothing. It's just something added just to throw on.
Well, there's no problem with running and having a child and taking the time off that you need to take off. But sort of looking at the sort of Trump playbook in terms of Michigan, though,
You have to remember she's running against the chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee, the former chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Debbie Stabenow is very well liked in the agricultural community. So rural Michigan may not be there for Epstein the same way rural Michigan was there for Trump. So just got to kind of get to keep that in mind, too.
Yeah. All right, let's take a look at some polling that we saw this morning from Target Insight. They did some work for Detroit News. John, they kind of came back with the same results that we saw when we worked with Dennis Denno on the Detroit polling, and that Coleman Young is down pretty significantly with in a battle with incumbent Mayor Mike Duggan. But that's not what struck me. What struck me is that the folks in the neighborhood don't feel like their life is getting any better. In fact, a plurality feel like poverty's up, crime is up, educational opportunities is down, and job prospects aren't going anywhere.
The perception in the neighborhoods have always been a big issue in terms of Detroit's mayoral races. But you have to remember, too, though, Duggan does have a message there. I mean, remember when he took office, the percentage of lights that were not operating, street lights that were not operating in the city of Detroit. That situation has been corrected. He's actually making strides on issues, and he can make the case. He's making strides on issues of importance to the neighborhood. So he's got a message he can deliver in response. Granted, they may not be as happy as they could be, but he does have a response, something to come back to.
What was your reactions to the poll numbers, Jack?
It looked to me like it showed Duggan in good shape in Detroit in terms of the situation when you ask, you know, who are you going to vote for, but with underlying weak numbers on with the actual situation in terms of identifying things like crime, et cetera, and what people thought that things were not headed in the right direction. It was kind of like, here's the overall picture. The paint on the outside looks pretty good. But gee, if you dig a little bit underneath, you know, maybe that wasn't going to, like the potential was there for maybe some of those cracks to start showing. That's what it looked like to me.
For Coleman Young, that's got to be good.
Oh, yeah. Coleman Young, it gave Coleman Young, I would think, some hope that, hey, here's what I know, what I know to pick at. Here's what I know to talk about. Here's what I know, you know, is going to resonate.
So what did you get out of this, Mike?
Well, Duggan recently presented a state of the city to House committee recently, and he has a lot of statistics regarding what improvements that he's made. And one of the things that I thought of when I was reading the poll results is they were talking about blight increasing, and he can show you how many houses they've taken down, and he's got quite a few statistics to support that they're making some progress down there. He's gonna have to take those numbers and really make a sales pitch with them, because to hear him tell it, they are making some progress there, but it's not reflected in the poll numbers at all.
Well, and maybe this is an opportunity for the mayor to explain what has been done in the last 4 years since he's been the mayor, because I don't know if that message has gotten out. I don't know if the statistics on the number of houses they've torn down is out, or maybe if there's some good police figures that he can relate to. Maybe response times are down, or you know, there are other statistics that maybe he has not taken the time to go out and sell himself and pound himself on the chest, but really there are probably opportunities for him to do so, and this could be the opportunity. So maybe this is a way to, maybe this campaign will be Duggan's way to show that improvements have been made, even if people haven't necessarily sensed it on their own. One last thing. Mark Bernstein, attorney at law. I just saw an ad for him yesterday, as a matter of fact, but that could be because I was watching an old show. It was only a month old, but Mark Bernstein has been on the air. From what I'm understanding, this potential race for governor has gotten fairly serious, and that he could very well make a run for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. And I want to get some thoughts around the room here about that possibility. There are certainly some advantages, I would say, John. Obviously, his access to money and his name ID being top on the list.
Oh, absolutely. With the absence of Dan Kildee from the race now, it does open up an opportunity for somebody to jump in. And he's certainly got the name recognition. He's certainly got the resources to run a very strong statewide campaign. And it's going to be interesting to see how he matches up, and when we look at polls in a few months after this is all settled out, to see where he lines up against former Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer and former Detroit Health Department Director Al Sayed. And we'll see how that lines up.
What would be some disadvantages you would see with Mark Bernstein being a gubernatorial candidate, Jack? Because it seems like being the head of a law firm, there's got to be some bad cases he's picked up.
Well, how do you make that transition when you're known on TV, that face is the guy who's up there telling, you know, selling himself as an attorney? I think that transition may be smooth, but perhaps it may not be that smooth. Hey, I'm selling myself as an attorney. I've been doing so in years, and now I'm going to sell myself as a governor. I think you got to be careful how you do that. I also think that there's a possibility of, obviously, he's going to have cases in his past that can probably be exploited by his opponents. Such and such a thing happened, and boy, you know, he really doesn't look very good if you look at what happened in this case or that case. He's probably got a whole, you know, his opponents probably have a whole card file on potential court cases that they could use as examples of, you know, well, look at this one. Look what he did on this one that he lost, or this one. His client only made so much money on it after his long period of time. His opponent, his client won, but when he came out in the end, look at, he might as well have lost, you know, these kinds of things.
Right. And I was talking, that's a good point. I was talking to a Republican operative about this last week, and he made the point that you could certainly take that Bernstein advantage and turn it into the Bernstein disadvantage fairly quickly if you phrase it right. You could also make the argument that he's an ambulance chaser, right? And you had mentioned off air here, you could make probably some pretty compelling ads in that regard.
Oh, yeah. Start out with the flashing red light, and vroom, down the street the ambulance goes, and now here comes, you know, the Bernstein car following it. It's a mixed bag. I think he has to be aware of those things going in. I'm sure he probably is, but it's a bit delicate, I think.
You know what I can't help but think while we're talking about this is just think about how well his brother did for Supreme Court. I mean, Richard Bernstein really kicked some serious rear in that Supreme Court case and really won it going away.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it really speaks to the power of name ID. I mean, it's just if you wanted to set up a future career for office, you know, you have this like statewide, you know, law firm that, you know, be on the TV commercials that we can all relate to. So, and it certainly did well for Justice Richard Bernstein, and I think the name ID, you can't underestimate that for Mark. What as we get kind of more crowded here in the Democratic primary, it's going to be interesting to see if Mark gets in, kind of where he distinguishes himself. You know, if Gretchen Whitmer capitalizing off of the resistance movement to Donald Trump, you have Abdul Al-Sayed trying to maybe label himself as a progressive candidate, and I don't know if this is a one-week fad, but with Jeffrey Figer trying to, you know, take the populist message out of the Trump playbook again, it'd be interesting to see where Mark Bernstein would position himself among the Democratic candidates if he gets in.
All right, well, let's move on to our interview portion of the podcast.
The line is a representative from the 100th District. He is Scott Van Single from Grant. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, good morning, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you on because of your background and your experience in finance and accounting. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of background here on your experience on the financial and accounting end of the world?
Yeah, my first college degree is actually in personal financial planning under a finance major, and I got that from Central Michigan University. I worked for a little while as a financial planner and then went back and got an accounting degree. So kind of have a little bit of experience on both angles from finance and accounting, and it's always been a passion of mine, retirement planning, both personally and just for whatever reason, investing has always fascinated me. So I sort of naturally gravitated towards this issue when I got down here to Lansing.
Talk to us about pensions then. Then you should have some experience here on retirement and pensions and 401ks and all that kind of stuff. Since this is a debate right now in the state capitol about the teacher retirement and pension system, how common are pensions, and what do you see as being advantages or disadvantages with them?
Yeah, they're increasingly rare in the private sector and even trending that way in the government sector. And a lot of that is just the risk. The employer forever bears the risk of the plan, where the 401k, the employee bears the risk, and the employer is only liable for the amount of the payroll contribution. So given market returns and just some of the wild fluctuations we've had in economic, the Great Recession a few years ago, employers are increasingly trending away from pensions.
But employees would probably really like pensions, don't they? I mean, when given the choice, it seems like it's a bit more stable.
Yeah, it certainly transfers the risk to your employer, but not all pensions are all that generous when you look at it. The MIPSERS pension, for example, that we're discussing, I would say is fairly generous, but in reality you will end up with about 50% of your pay as a benefit if you work a 30-plus year career. Nobody's getting rich off that. If you retire with a $70,000 salary, that comes out to about $35,000 a year, which is a nice benefit, but it's not a tremendous amount of money, and it's actually quite easy to replace with a 401k-style system.
Hmm. So let's look at the hybrid system then that new employees for public schools have here in the state of Michigan. You have the pension, and then you have a 401k option. From a financial advisor standpoint, give us a little bit of a comparison between the two.
Yeah, the pension benefit, defined benefit, costs 3% of payroll for the employer, and then the employees are on a graded scale based on their salary. I believe it goes up to 6.4%. So the total contribution between the employee and the employer is approaching 10%. There's also a 401k type component to that where the employer puts in a 1% match, and that's basically to make up for the cost of living increase that no longer exists in the new defined benefit plan. You can choose that, or you can choose the straight defined contribution plan, and it's somewhere around 20%, I believe, that pick that, and it's really not that good of an option right now. The match, and forgive me for not knowing the exact number, it's either 2 or 3%, which personally, if I had the option, I would take the pension, given the option between the two.
Wow. Now, what is kind of the standard out there in the industry as far as 401k matches?
Really, 3 and 4% is typical in most companies. The company that I came from before going into the legislature, we were at 6%, which is a little bit above average.
Mm-hmm.
But it varies by industry and how profitable the company is and how stable they are.
So if you were advising a new school employee and they had the choice between taking the pension option or taking the 401k, you would advise for the pension then?
Yeah, it depends on your circumstances. One of the problems with the pension is you don't vest until 10 years. So if you only intend on working 7, 8, 9 years and possibly starting a family or going into a different career, you probably would be best taking the 401k option, and at least you'll walk away with something. But so it depends on the circumstance for every employee.
Mm-hmm. How could the state make the 401k option more enticing? At what point does taking the 401k become a better option than the pension?
There's no exact number, but I would say in one of the proposals that I had was that you sweeten the 401k and basically make it what state legislators and other state employees get, which is a 7% match.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, quite generous, but it's a good benefit, and I think that would naturally draw people out of the pension plan, and we don't know what the exact numbers are because you're dealing with human nature, but I would guess it would be close to 50% would probably pick the 401k, and that naturally would shrink the pension plan.
Now, you said a proposal that you're tossing around. Is that, tell us about the actual proposal. Is that what it is then, sweetening the 401k? And do you have other alternatives to closing MIPSERS?
Yeah, there actually has not been a bill introduced yet to my knowledge. So anything we talk about is speculation. But from what I've heard, it most likely will look like the Senate bills that were proposed in lame duck last year, which is to close the fine benefit plan and do exactly that, make the 401k 7%. But there's a lot of upfront costs that come with that. So, and then you're going from a plan that costs 3 to 4% of payroll to 7. So there's an ongoing cost that never comes out cheaper, and then there's upfront costs. So I've been hesitant to embrace that scenario. I really think the possibly just sweetening the 401k option is the best option for now, naturally drawing people out of the pension plan, and then possibly looking at closure someday if that makes sense, or looking at making the system sustainable.
And making the system sustainable means putting more money into it, correct?
Potentially. We think some of the assumptions are still wrong on the hybrid plan. It's a lot closer to the correct number than what the prior pension system was. It's fully funded at this point. So I think we need to review some of those assumptions. Right now it's at a 7% assumed rate of return. We may be able to hit that, but that may be on the high end also. And also there's 3.5% payroll growth assumed in the assumptions. That's actually been flat to negative over the last few years. So we probably need to make some adjustments there to capture what the true cost of the plan is and then fund it accordingly.
So just in short here then, your idea is that if we can sweeten the pot on the 401k side, match it to what the state offers at least at 7%, then we could naturally see a phasing out of the interest in the pension end of the hybrid.
Right, and especially with our younger generation that's going into the workforce, they want that flexibility and portability, and a pension is really not something that's on their mind at 22, 23 years old going into the workforce. But on the other hand, we do have to think about there is a potential teacher shortage coming up in the next few years, or actually I'm quite certain there will be when you look at college enrollment for teaching programs. And what if it is 10 or 15% of people that this pension was just enough to entice them into the teaching profession? Most of them, that wasn't a factor, but what if it is 10 or 15%? And you're already facing a shortage, and now you take 10 or 15% of the people out of the workforce, you have a bigger problem. So I think leaving the system open but trying to naturally shrink how many people go into it and making sure our assumption's correct is probably the best option in the near term.
How much have you run the numbers or had anybody run the numbers on how much extra it would cost to sweeten the pot on the 401k side?
I believe if we completely closed it and shifted everybody, they were projecting about $20 million a year, and then the next year it would be something like 40, and then 60 the next year. It grows as every new age class of teacher comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So you would probably be somewhere in the ballpark of half of that number if you're only shifting about half the people over.
So as far as a dollar figure then, from what you can see, you're only putting in half of what you would otherwise if you were to close it.
Well, that's just the normal cost. If you close the system, there's upfront cost, and there's a lot of debate about what those upfront costs are.
Mm-hmm.
Part of those have to do with we're recommended to have more conservative investments, which you would have to lower your assumed rate of return. And I've seen different numbers. It depends on what group is putting them together, because there is opinion that goes into this. But I've seen numbers anywhere from $500 to $800 million a year ongoing for years. And I've seen that total number in the range of $20 to $25 billion over the next 30 years. And that's just the upfront cost. And then there's the ongoing cost of, the difference between the divine benefit, or the normal cost, the difference between the 4% and the 7%. And that's projected to be in the $800 million range 30 years from now annually. So I'm looking at those numbers, and I'm not seeing where the lines ever cross to where completely closing the system actually saves money. And there is sweetening the pot, as I've suggested, there is an ongoing cost to that as well, but it's nowhere near that magnitude.
So have you taken this idea to the governor or leadership?
I had a meeting with the governor last Wednesday, and it was an interesting conversation. We actually had some of the same ideas, which was encouraging. Slight variations on that idea, and he had some ideas in addition to that as far as maybe reforming some of the post-retirement health care benefits as well, and looking for ways to save money there, and then shifting some of that money into the pension system. So would like to hear more about what he has to say, and I know the House and Senate leadership has been in discussions with him as far as different options, and I really applaud the House and Senate leadership for taking this issue up. It's one of the biggest issues the state is facing right now, and it's one of those things not a lot of people fully understand because it's so complicated that it's easy to sweep under the rug, and you know, we can see a pothole in the road, but it's hard to visually see a unfunded liability in a pension plan.
Now, did you ask for the meeting with the governor, or did he invite you in?
He actually invited me in, which meant a lot to me, and I was happy to share my ideas with him, and good listener. We had a great discussion, and I think it was productive for both of us.
Do you know if what the speaker thought of that?
I haven't had a conversation with him yet about that, but I would be happy to share anything I've learned or my opinions with him if he is interested.
Do you see any prospect of you introducing a bill in regards to this?
That wasn't in my plan. I'm happy to share my ideas and work through this process, and if it takes the shape of a bill, I would be happy to do whatever leadership wants me to do as far as my role in that, and we'll see where this discussion goes in the next few weeks.
But I guess you could say that this would be a pretty good compromise in the sense that you would be further addressing the unfunded liability on the teacher pension side and the hybrid and all that without the enormous upfront costs and the additional strain on either the school aid budget or the general fund.
Right. I personally think it's a good idea. It's going to be up to our leadership team if that's the direction they want to pursue. And one note of clarification, quite often the $29 billion debt that's in the old system gets lumped in with this discussion, and they're really two separate discussions. The hybrid plan is fully funded. It's not in debt, and whatever we do will not change the $29 billion debt on the old system. So the other part of this discussion is aggressively continuing to pay down that debt, and we've been making good progress on that. It's over $1 billion a year extra beyond the normal costs that we've been putting into that. And I would advocate that some of these short-term surpluses that we're seeing, like in the current year, that we continue to apply those to the debt. And we had run some numbers on this. We were originally looking at a $500 million surplus this year, and I know the revenue estimates weren't as rosy as what we thought last week. But if we applied a $500 million this year extra to that debt, it takes $1.7 billion off the debt immediately. It shaves about a year and a half off the 21-year payoff time. So that would be my recommendation for what we do in the near term as far as the unfunded liability on the old plan.
Now, with this hybrid system, though, nobody's drawing any benefit out of it, though, right? So, I mean, it wouldn't be, of course, it would still be fully funded because there's nobody drawing out of it.
That's not really how it works. I think quite often people think that these plans are a cash flow basis, sort of like Social Security, where we're in desperate need of people paying into the system to pay people on the other end. There's an asset that's built up as people pay into the system, and there's also a liability that's built up as they accrue years of service. And those have roughly been equal as the plan builds, and that's exactly how a pension plan is supposed to work. So I think people get a little bit confused with that argument. I would not say that's true, that that's why the plan is fully funded.
Oh, okay. So the old system and the hybrid system are not intermingled funds then?
They're in the same pot of money. There aren't two separate investment pools.
Okay.
For accounting purposes, they are separate. They're both accruing assets and liabilities separately.
All right. Any other thoughts on this subject here before we let you go?
No, I appreciate the chance to share my thoughts, and open to talk to anybody on this issue. And I am by no means an expert, but this has been a passion of mine, and I just honestly hope we come to the right answer, whatever that is, here in the next few weeks or whenever we come to a final agreement on this.
Very good. Representative Scott Van Singel, a Republican from Grant, 100th District, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Representative Van Singel for taking the time today, AT&T for sponsoring this, and all of our podcast guys here, Mike Malott, Jake Kanzler, Jack Spencer and John Roerink. And as John's getting all pumped up and excited about the Mackinac Policy Conference from the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce next week, we thought it might be good. Jack, you've got some experience on Mackinac Island.
Oh, yes. Yes. 3 summers back when I was 19, 20, and 21. And
you got to stay in the horse stables, right?
I was a shy kid from the middle of the mitten, and I went up there, and my bunk and everything was in the quarters over the stables.
I must have gotten a little smelly.
Yeah, and I got over being shy because of it. I made up my mind after about 6 days that I was going to find something else to do every evening. And I would hit them at breakfast. I would go right down the line asking girls out. I was somewhat choosy, but not overly so. At one point, after having gone out something like 56 consecutive nights.
56?
Yeah, and that's not arbitrary. I was keeping track. I happened to have a young lady who was a maid who went out with me, and we stopped at the fence there looking down at the yard in front of the grand, and she said, "The maids have made a bet. You're trying to hit somebody from all 50 states, aren't you?" And I said, "No, it didn't really occur to me." And
you developed a reputation.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I was literally, you have to understand, to go out 56 straight nights like that, you didn't worry about taking no for an answer. You just would go to the next person who was having oatmeal or whatever. And I just was going to have a date that night. And you have to remember, up there, you don't have to pay for gasoline. You know, all you need, you know, is enough for a cinnamon roll and a cheap bottle of wine, and you're in business. And yeah, I left the island just nowhere near as bashful a person as I was when I first went up there.
Memories of Jack. Boy, we should sponsor this.
No, I don't know about that. I just find it funny that your reputation as a bachelor extraordinaire was driven by the smell of horse shit.
Well, with that's going to do it for this week's edition. I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.